Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Corrine Carey. She's the Senior State Director for New York and New Jersey of Compassion and Choices. Compassion and Choices is the nation's oldest and largest nonprofit committed to improving care and expanding choice at the end of life. Before joining Compassion and Choices, Corrine Carey served for a decade as Deputy Legislative Director at the New York Civil Liberties Union. She also worked as a researcher with the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. She is a graduate of SUNY Buffalo Law School and has a master's in American Studies from the University of Buffalo. And I'm speaking to Corrine Carey by phone from her office in New York. Corrine Carey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, I want you to tell us a little bit about the history of Compassion and Choices. Who founded it? What were some of the initial reasons?
Compassion and Choices is the nation's oldest, largest, and most active nonprofit organization working to really improve care for people and expand their choices at the end of life. Our organization was founded by our president, Barbara Coombs Lee, you know, more than 30 years ago. She was an emergency room nurse and also a lawyer, very interesting combination. And she witnessed the death of someone really important to her, a former lawmaker in Oregon. And she had witnessed, you know, a lot of painful deaths, a lot of suffering in her time as an ER nurse. And this one touched her very deeply. And so she, together with a few colleagues at her Unitarian church, got together and decided to do something about it. This lawmaker had sponsored what was called death with dignity bills in the past, and they hadn't made it through the legislature. Barbara, who's always been prescient, knew that public opinion was turning in the favor of these compassionate laws. And so she decided to take a different tack, which was to work together with her colleagues to introduce a referendum. The first medical aid in dying law in this country was passed by public referendum in Oregon in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
So our organization has been working to expand those options for people throughout this country, but also on a whole host of other measures that improve care at the end of life, from ensuring that people have timely access to hospice care and really empowering patients to understand what their options are and how to get what they want and deserve from the healthcare system.
Yeah, that's a tough one in this day and age. So tell us, when someone calls and says they're terminal and they need help with medical aid, tell us what you say to them and whether you refer them to specific places around the country.
So we don't refer people to physicians who practice in states that authorize medical aid in dying. That's not what we're about. We empower patients with information about what options are available to them and how to best advocate for themselves. We also do a tremendous amount of training and technical assistance to governments, government agencies, healthcare providers. And really, we believe that the healthcare system needs to be responsive to patients' wishes. So we try to arrange things so that patients can ask for what they want and need, and healthcare providers have the tools to deliver that care.
Is there still resistance to this, based on God knows what, probably religious grounds? But do you find a lot of resistance still?
Well, every law on the books, and now there are, 10 jurisdictions that allow for medical aid in dying. Every one of those laws makes it clear that medical aid in dying is voluntary for everyone, voluntary for the patient and voluntary for the healthcare provider. What we've found is that the majority of doctors in this country agree that terminally ill people should have the option to ask for medical aid in dying should their suffering become too great. And in theory, there are a number of doctors that are hesitant to say that they'll participate. What we found is that it really takes a personal connection with a patient in front of them, who they've been treating, and for whom they may not have any more options to relieve that patient's suffering. And so it's really about the relationship between the doctor and the patient, and whatever hesitation there was to act under these medical aid in dying laws, to actually write the prescription, that often changes when the patient is right in front of the doctor asking for help.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
I think that these laws take some getting used to. The law in New Jersey, for example, just went into effect on August 1st. And what we've seen over the past 22 years of implementation of these laws is that the healthcare profession becomes much more comfortable as the law matures. And so what we've seen in Oregon and now what we're seeing in California is that more doctors are willing to respond to those requests from patients. There may be some concern that the practice of medical aid in dying is isolated to just a small number of physicians, but we're finding that that's not the case. I think that as this issue becomes more mainstream, we'll see a greater number of healthcare providers willing to consider these requests as they come in from their patients.
Yeah. But what kind of choices do people have, though? They can request certain drugs or certain remedies. How does that work? And is it each individual doctor decides that, I assume?
Well, you're right. None of the laws that authorize medical aid in dying set forth what kinds of medications need to be used. Mm-hmm. And that's smart public policy. You don't want to tell doctors how to practice medicine. There are advances in medicine all of the time. There are varying availability because of our pharmaceutical industry. Not all drugs are always available all the time. So doctors have flexibility. What I know is that they share information with one another. There have been clinical practice guidelines published in peer-reviewed medical journals. And so there's a lot of doctor-to-doctor conversations about how best to practice. And in fact, we offer a doctor-to-doctor consultation line so that physicians in newly authorized states or physicians who aren't familiar with this practice can consult with other doctors who are. But your question is, I think, even deeper than that, because I think you asked what options do people have.
And then what do they ask for? I was just wondering, and is it made available depending on the request, or are there limitations?
Well, I think the way that I want to answer your question is that what patients are asking for is a relief from suffering, however they define suffering. And the options right now are very limited in states where medical aid in dying is not authorized. One can stop eating and drinking. It's called VSED, or voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. And you can do that generally with the support of a physician to palliate, you know, any side effects from any discomfort from stopping eating and drinking. Mm-hmm. Some people report that that's a very peaceful way to die, and others have reported, you know, extreme agitation, and it's a very difficult process for a family to watch. Another option that people have is called palliative sedation. Basically, you are sedated and nutrition and hydration are withheld. And basically, you know, you're unconscious, unable to say goodbye at the time of passage. And so for some people, that option isn't desirable either. Their family hold a death vigil at the bedside. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then of course there is just suffering with the pain, with as much pain medication as you want. And that's how my father died, actually. He's Catholic. He believed in the redemptive power of suffering, and he wanted to experience all of it until the end. And that's an option for people as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think this whole notion of death with dignity, some people think it's equated with medical aid in dying. For me, death with dignity means that you die the way that you want to. Mm-hmm. Certainly with any of those choices, I consider the fact that my father died at home surrounded by his loved ones a dignified death. My father died with dignity.
Yeah, that is important. I mean, people in the previous years and decades of the medical profession, people didn't even think of that.
Right.
So we've come a long way in regard to that too. Listen, I want to ask you about this. A lot of end-of-life advocates, they steer clear often of the term assisted suicide. So talk to us about that, too.
Sure. I think there are two issues with calling medical aid in dying assisted suicide. One is that it's not assisted. I think this conjures this notion of a physician administering medication to help someone die. Mm-hmm. This is an entirely patient-directed process. The patient receives the prescription. It's up to them whether and when to pick that prescription up, and then it's up to them whether and when they ever use it. And between a quarter and a third of people who receive a prescription for medical aid in dying end up never using it for a variety of reasons. So this notion of assisted is problematic. It's not an assisted death. It's a self-directed death. Mm-hmm. The second problem with that term is the term suicide. anyone who knows someone who has either been an advocate for medical aid in dying, someone who's living with a terminal illness and wants this option, these are people who desperately want to live. They're in no hurry to die. Suicide is when someone who can otherwise live chooses death over life. Mm. Medical aid in dying is when someone knows they're dying, and in the words of one of our supporters who just passed, they want to rob the illness of its final prize. They would rather live, but the illness is taking them.
That's really interesting. Okay, the next question I wanted to ask you is, if a patient decides that they want to have assistance in ending their suffering, if a doctor is opposed to it that's treating that person, how do they remedy that?
Well, we encourage people to have conversations with their providers early and often. You know, oftentimes what we find is that people are waiting far too long to talk to their loved ones, to their providers, about what they want in terms of their end-of-life care. Mm. And it's often too late by the time they've started that conversation. It's important for all of us to talk to the people around us. And so what we've been saying to supporters in states that authorize this option is that they should talk to their physicians sooner rather than later. And if their physicians aren't willing to provide the kind of care that they want, they need to consider switching to another provider.
Ah, that is a choice, just no matter what the medical problems are. Yeah, a lot of people don't think they can quit their doctors.
It's true, but I think all of us who've dealt with the healthcare system in one way or another have experienced providers that may not be providing care that's centered on what we want. And that's the time that you need to start reevaluating whether that provider is right for you.
Yeah, yeah. Now, talk to us about the Medical Aid in Dying Act.
New York's Medical Aid in Dying Act is a law that it's modeled after every law that has come before it in this country. There are now 9 states, 10 jurisdictions that allow for medical aid in dying, and New York's bill mirrors the core provisions in Oregon's law and every law that has been passed since. In short, it allows someone who is terminally ill, and that's defined as someone who has an illness that is incurable and irreversible. So long as they are given a 6-month prognosis that is estimated to live 6 months or less, they can ask their physician for a prescription for medication that they can take at a time of their choosing or never, should their suffering become unbearable, so long as they can self-administer the medication. Mm. That's the core of the law. There are more than a dozen safeguards that are attached to that law, including, you know, the fact that the person has to make one oral request, one written request. That written request needs to be witnessed by 2 people. And if either the consulting or the attending physician, 2 doctors have to confirm both the diagnosis and the prognosis. If either one of those doctors has any doubt about whether the patient has mental capacity, they need to refer that person to a mental health professional.
Ah, so it could take some time.
And it often does take some time. Some of these laws have waiting periods. What we found is that those waiting periods are often superseded by the time that it takes to put all of those pieces into place. So sometimes people are waiting 30, 60 days before all of those requirements can be met.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Corinne Carey. She is the Senior State Director for New York and New Jersey's Compassion and Choices. And Compassion and Choices is the nation's oldest nonprofit committed to improving care and expanding choice at the end of life. I'm from California, and there's a different tact on that. They have something called the End of Life Option Act. Can you tell us about that? Is it different than the Medical Aid in Dying Act?
No, not at all. The core provisions in California's End of Life Option Act are exactly the same as New York's Medical Aid in Dying Act. Every state that has authorized this practice follows Oregon's model, which is kind of extraordinary if you think about it.
Yeah.
It was the first law ever to be passed. It was passed by public referendum in 1994. It went into effect in 1997. And you'd think that there would be tweaks or fixes or amendments to that law, since it was really, you know, the first experiment in this country with medical aid in dying. But never did this law ever have to be fixed or expanded or tweaked. And every state since then has used the Oregon model.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I lived in the Netherlands for a while, and I was so astonished that they had this act in the country's, you know, guidelines for people with illness. I was shocked, actually, when I was there in the early 90s. It's nice that we're catching up in this country.
It is, but I think it's important to note that our laws in the United States are very different from laws in Europe.
Yes.
The laws in Europe allow many more people to take advantage of what in some countries may be called euthanasia. In this country, you have to be terminally ill and you have to be within 6 months of death, which is a very strict guideline.
Yeah. And if somebody is terminally ill and still somewhat with it, say, can a family member make that decision for them in some way?
No, that's one of the most important safeguards in this law. When I say this is self-directed, I mean that in every sense of the word. The person has to be mentally capable of making the decision, and it can't be delegated to anyone else.
Mm.
This is not something you can put in your living will. It's not something that you can delegate to a health proxy. This decision has to be made contemporaneously. You have to be able to self-ingest the medication when the time comes. And this is, it's so important because it means that people can change their mind at any point in this process. And that's a very important safeguard.
Oh, yes, I would imagine. Now, you know, you were talking earlier about how patients can refuse food and water as a way to get out of their dilemma. Can patients legally do that without force feeding being enacted or something like that?
Absolutely. The practice of VSED, or voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, is legal in every state.
Mm.
So people who are terminally ill have that option.
Wow, that's amazing to me. I'm surprised the medical profession has allowed that. You offer on your website the End of Life Decisions Guide. Tell us a little bit about that. It's really quite interesting and all pervasive in regard to questions.
Yeah, the guide is really valuable for people who are facing serious and terminal medical situations. It helps guide someone through thinking about what their values are. What kinds of things do they care about at the end of life? Do they care about extending life at all costs, or do they care about quality versus quantity of life? It gives people suggestions about how to talk to their loved ones and how to talk to their providers. It provides examples of sample forms, sample questionnaires to interview hospices, for example, to make sure that the hospice that you choose, if hospices is something that you want to avail yourself of, are you choosing the right kind of hospice that will reflect your values at the end of life? So it really is a very comprehensive guide for anyone who is facing their own terminal illness or someone who is helping a loved one navigate the healthcare system.
Yeah, I would imagine there's probably so many questions that people don't think of when they decide to embark on this journey, really, is what it is. Tell us a little bit about volunteer opportunities. Are they different in different chapters, or is there a basis of care that volunteers need to be part of?
Oh, sure. It definitely varies. There are states that have this option, and we're looking for volunteers that are willing to do public education presentations. Bring this issue to your local library, to a Kiwanis club or a Rotary club, and talk to your neighbors. There are film screenings that volunteers can help put on in their own communities. In states where this option is not yet authorized, it's really about mobilizing and empowering people to speak to their own elected officials. So right now in New York, we've got volunteers across the state who are talking to their their neighbors, their families, their friends about reaching out to elected officials to ask them to take action in 2020 and authorize this option. So, you know, the volunteer opportunities really vary, and we would encourage anyone who, you know, wants to ensure that people have access to the full range of options at the end of life to get in touch with us, because if you have 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour or more, there's a place for you in any of our work across the country.
Now, you know, since Compassion and Choices and so many other organizations, as well as hospice, have been available, is there less fear about dying? Because I still know so many people who don't even want to talk about this.
Yeah, I face the same reaction from people. I think that there is a lot of resistance in this country to talking about death and dying. But I think that that's changing. There have been a number of writers.
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross comes to my mind, yeah.
Yeah, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. My father was a hospice volunteer. He read Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's books. But even more recently, there's a writer who's done work in the New Yorker magazine. His name is Atul Gawande, and he wrote a book called Being Mortal. And many book clubs across the country picked up that book. And it is, if you haven't read it, if you haven't checked it out, it's incredible. And I think that he is part of what some are calling a revolution in thinking about death and dying in this country. There are people that are thinking about alternative ways of burial or what you do with the body once we've passed. There are people who are talking about death doulas. Many of us know what birth doulas are. There's someone there to support the mother during the birth process. Now there are death doulas. People who are there to help guide someone in this final passage. There are others that are pointing out the incongruity of celebrating with such zest in this country birth, but we don't do the same at the end of life. And I think that those things are changing as we talk more and more about death and dying in this country. So I think it's changing, but we're not there yet.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of work to do. And I must say again, Being Mortal is a great book. Please, and anybody who's listening, go out and buy it if you're interested in this subject. To tell us a little bit about the Truth in Treatment initiative.
So Truth in Treatment is really all about helping patients talk to their providers about the risks and benefits of different kinds of treatment. There are tools on our website that allow people to look at the kinds of questions that they should be asking when they go to their provider. Oftentimes, providers may try to guess, you know, whether their patients want the full truth, you know, more information rather than less, or do they want to be dealt with in an easier way? Our Truth in Treatment initiative is helping people navigate those conversations with their providers. If they've been given a serious diagnosis, it helps them think through how to talk to their doctor about how they want their doctor to communicate their options to them. Do they want the hard truth all the time? Do they want to know exactly what's going to happen to their bodies at every stage of treatment? What will happen if the treatment works? What if it doesn't work? What are the other options? Or are there people that would rather leave those decisions in the hands of their providers? It really helps people navigate those conversations.
You know what I was wondering, and these are volatile times we're living in. Are there people who are totally opposed to this kind of work? People on religious grounds that are fighting some of these initiatives and even some of this education?
Well, I will say that I think that the desire to not see our loved ones suffer is universal. Mm. And we've seen, you know, people that may be fundamentally opposed to medical aid and dying in theory, they also don't want to see their loved ones suffer. And many change their minds when they've seen this up close. But there certainly is still a core of people who would deny this option to others because of their own religious beliefs. And that's one of the hardest parts of my job, is really knowing that that this option is effective. The laws have been used as intended for, you know, a quarter of a century now. And there are still people who believe, because of their own faith beliefs, that this option shouldn't be available to others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have met people who said, why are you going to talk about this? It's immoral. And you know what I wanted to do, too? I wanted to ask you, how has this work affected you? Have you had to navigate different ways of coping?
Well, you know, I got into this work. I spent about a decade with the New York Civil Liberties Union working on a whole host of public health issues, public health and privacy. I was also teaching a class at the City University of New York on the politics of health. And it was before, during, and after the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And it was around that time that I started reading about the death panel. During the authorization of the Affordable Care Act, there was a provision in that law that would have allowed doctors to be reimbursed for conversations that they were having with their patients about the kind of care that they wanted at the end of life. And opponents to the Affordable Care Act branded that provision a death panel provision.
Yes, yes, I remember.
And basically painted it as a government panel that would decide whether grandma could live or die. It was a complete fiction. In fact, what that provision would have done is just allowed for more open and honest conversations between doctors and their patients. But that provision was taken away. It was excised from the Affordable Care Act. And as we know, the Affordable Care Act went on to be approved. After that, my organization stuck around in DC and worked with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare to make sure that providers are reimbursed. So that, you know, provision that was labeled death panels is now part of the fabric of our healthcare payment system.
Oh, that's great.
And that's thanks to, you know, Compassion and Choices and other organizations that knew how important that was. Well, I was teaching this material and my father was given a diagnosis of stage 4 cancer. And so all of these issues of end-of-life care, reading Atul Gawande's material, his book Being Mortal, all of it became less interesting academically and very relevant personally.
Yes. Corinne, we're almost out of time. Can I ask you to give some contact information and your website?
Folks who are interested in Compassion and Choices can find us online at www.compassionandchoices.org. We're also on Facebook. You can find the New York campaign at Compassion and Choices New York. And you can also find us on Twitter.
Well, great. Well, Corinne Carey, thank you so much for joining us. Great work that you guys do. And I'm so happy to get the word out. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.